Hello, and thank you for coming to this live stream with me, Nick Dixon, and Ed Dutton, aka the Jolly Heretic. We organized this in a fairly impromptu fashion today because we wanted to talk about this viral article in Compact Magazine from Jacob Savage, which sounds a relatively obscure thing, but it isn't because it's gone viral. And it's about how DEI destroyed a generation of white men, which just happens to be my generation, the millennials. And this has gone viral, and it's even reached JD Vance's attention. And as two people who have suffered the brunt of this pogrom of careers that I'm calling the white menicide, I thought it'd be great to talk to Ed about it, and we can share our experiences and the wider implications and how it's affected Zoomer men as well, who have been radicalized, of course, by this atrocity. So, Ed, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, we had the same idea. I mean, I contacted you earlier, and you said, "Yeah, I'm doing that anyway."
Yeah. You can
And I
join my
thought,
thing if you want.
yeah. You go, which who where do we run this? And
Right.
I just thought to myself. I immediately thought of you, Nick, because of course you're 1 school year younger than me. You're basically exactly a year younger. So I know that's the border of whatever millennial and zestanial or some bollocks. But
Exactly. We're both centennials, but yeah.
it's the same experience. And the article in Compact actually says, yeah, if you were born in 90, if you were born in 74, if you were therefore established by 2014 and you were a white man, you're probably okay. But if
Yeah.
you were born in 84, whatever, 10 years later, then you're not established. You're only in your 30, you're only 30 by the time this really took off. And
Yeah, it
so
says at
then
one point, if you were 30 in 2014, and I was like a couple of years off that, and if you don't get your life exactly perfect and you're like, oh, I'm too late, but who could have predicted like the death cull? You sometimes blame yourself and say, oh, I could have just about got in as a millennial. I'm at the top of millennial, the oldest millennial, so I could have just about done it, but I didn't know they were going to cull all white men from all employment.
no, and also people get to their peak or whatever at different stages. So someone like Ricky Gervais was what in his late 30s when he actually became properly famous.
Yeah.
But he was of course born in, I think, was it 62 or something like that. So he was kind of okay. But people peak and are at their best or whatever at different and decide what they want to do at different stages. So it implies that if you're born in 1980, you've got to go for it. You've got to be winning your prize at the Edinburgh Festival of Comedy when you're about 22, 23, such that you're established 7 years later, or you're just screwed. And then you have a generation of people. They argue, as I think we've discussed before, Nick, that, well, yeah, it means that the absolute best white men, the super brilliant white men, may well get through. But I'm not even sure that's true, because then those people have to kowtow to political correctness in a very extreme way and can't joke about certain things and can't and have to be careful, of what they're funny about in comedy. But of course, what it means is that you get all these people that are getting through, all these people that are on the if in comedy on the panel shows or whatever, who are women and who are minorities, who just aren't very good.
Yeah.
And then people who are much objectively better than them, that in the 90s would have been there making people laugh, are not there. It's insane. And it's the same in academia, which was my background until relatively recently. And it's obviously the same in every other area of life. So you've got this, it's just weird seeing the statistics laid out like that. I don't know, there's
Yeah.
something about the numbers, don't you think, that it just hits you. My God, we've been through this
Yeah,
abuse essentially.
yeah. And so, yeah, so this is the article we're talking about, in case you don't know, The Lost Generation, Jacob Savage. And yeah, some of the numbers you're talking about, he, for example, here he talks about in 2011, the year I moved to Los Angeles, white men were 48% of lower level TV writers. In 2024, they accounted for just 11.9%. And then the Atlantic's editorial staff went from 53% male to 89%. No, sorry, went from 53% male and 89% white in 2013 to 36% male and 66% white in 2024. White men fell from 39% of tenure track positions in the humanities at Harvard in 2014 to 18% in 2023.
So that means they're already, it's already overwhelmingly female. It's
Yeah.
already overwhelmingly female. Nothing really needs to be done. They've already taken charge. They're
Already
already
taken off.
running tenure track programs at Harvard such that 60% of the people involved are women, basically, or minorities. And then that's not good enough. Then they have to push them down to 18%. And in some humanities subjects, they reported this article, it was as low as 7.9% white male.
Yeah, and this is all pre-2020 when it even took another exponential leap, you could say, with George, when an unfortunate American drug addict had a drug overdose, a criminal and drug addict, which was really sad. So it says, in retrospect, 2014 was the hinge, the year DEI became institutionalized across American life. Of course, we're talking about America, but it's absolutely the same here. I just watched an excellent video from someone today, actually, on this, who said he liked my content, which I didn't know. And he did a really, let me just shout him out. He did a brilliant video on this. I'll find it in a second. It's affected loads of people across the whole West. This was a guy, DEI ruined my career. Integral Views, he's called. So believe me, and he's on YouTube, so check it out, his video. It's everywhere. It's all across the West, and everyone's been coming out and saying the exact same thing. And just to talk about the comedy analogy and the year 2014 and so on, I started in 2011, was in the So You Think You're Funny final. We've talked about this before. Already, I did a normal sort of comedy set, but I was called a misogynist in the review of the final for doing normal jokes. I was like, that's weird. And the whole panel were women, and they had already decided they had to give it to a woman that year. And there was a woman in there who was sort of already too experienced. Everyone was going, why is she in it? And of course she won it. So that's how it already was. And then you go, okay, was I just about early enough to have a slither of a chance? But then you've got to learn skills. These are difficult things. You know, I've been writing comedy for 11 years. It's a very difficult skill to master. So you're not going to be good straight away. But by the time 2014 hit, as he's saying, it was already over. And I'd say even earlier in comedy, because comedy is kind of at the cutting edge.
I would say even earlier in academia. It only really hit me. I don't know why. I don't know why it only really hit me now. But it only really hit me reading the Social Compact article. At the time, it didn't really bother me that much. It's weird. But I applied for a job at Manchester University in the theology department as lecturer in theology. And the job was as good as mine, basically. As far as I can work out, I performed well in the interview. I was the best qualified person for the job. It was a shoo-in. And it was made pretty clear to me that it was a shoo-in. And then this Muslim girl applied, who had far fewer publications than me, and someone, it seems, from high up declared, no, you have to give it to the Muslim girl. And someone in the department, this was back in 2008, and someone in the department came to me and said, I can't believe it. You know, there is general amazement that this has happened there. You know, you were clearly the best qualified person for the job. This is extraordinary. But yeah, it didn't really hit me till I sort of thought vaguely about it. Well, hang on, that's not really fair. But then it occurred to me later, well, this is what was going on, even in academia in 2008.
It was massively known in comedy. It was an open secret. And even if you spoke to a fairly sort of lib white male comedian, if you scratch the surface, you could get him to admit that he was absolutely furious about it as well. You know, I said to one guy once, does this not bother you? He's like, yeah, but if I thought like that, I'd just get too angry. So it's like, they knew as well. It was, and it's an accepted thing. It was all just like how you could play the game. So for me, you were told you couldn't get anywhere. And as you said before, they always cite the few people that get through. You had to be the absolute best of the best of the best. Of course, someone like Sean Moss, who's a friend of mine in comedy, don't really speak to him much anymore just because we're in very different worlds, but he's a good guy. And he was such a great performer on stage, but he was like one of the absolute best. And he got in just before all this. And then even he had some problems with a Me Too nonsense thing, which was totally rubbish on that dancing show. And he had to work his way back in. But it was basically like the absolute elite best or someone that just had a particular angle or was particularly quirky or just like a James Acaster. People always cite these people. So you had to be the absolute best of the best of the best, because suddenly, instead of there being like six spots and they're all basically straight white men, because that's who does comedy in England, it was six spots at the Live at the Apollo. One of them's for a straight white man, five are for diversity, who have been going 10 seconds and done an open mic.
It's like at the moment you have they don't, obviously it's purely about ability. They don't do this, but imagine if they did. I, as you know, am a big fan of the darts. And at the moment at Ali Pali, there is the darts, PDC Darts Championship 2026 going on. Now, imagine if they had a rule where there had to be a certain number of women and a certain number of minorities, because darts is also white and male. It's overwhelmingly white, male and fat. And imagine if they had a rule where there had to be like a certain number of thin people. When Bill the Power Taylor lost weight about 10 years ago, his game got destroyed. I mean, he no longer had the balance. You know, he no longer had the ballast. his darts suffered. And then he ate a load of pies, and then he was okay. If they had that rule, it would be ridiculous. You'd just be watching loads and loads of people that were bad at darts. That's what you'd be doing, and nobody would enjoy it. And they'd look forward to the very occasional situation where they're, okay, some of these people, I don't know who, I'm trying to think of a middle-ranking darts kind of person off the top of my head. Simon Whitlock, let's say, right? Some of these people, right, they're not that good at darts. They're not like, well, they are good, but they're not like amazingly good, but they are at least reasonably good at darts. And sometimes they'll have some moments of darting brilliance. And so that kind of makes it worth it, that a lot of the time their darts sort of whatever. And it's the same with comedy, and maybe it's the same with academia as well, I don't know. Although it's not quite a good comparison, because academia is so politicized as well, in a way that comedy perhaps wasn't quite so much. But you're just watching something that's bad. You're being made to sit and watch, rather than a reasonably funny comedian who occasionally has moments of genius, like, you know, the Neil Kinnock of comedy. You know, he's reasonably good, and he occasionally has some excellent moments but not very often. Like that kind of person. Instead, you're just watching some woman or some ethnic minority who's just not very funny. Like there's that comedian, that female comedian that's got some really severe cerebral palsy, and she can't even speak. And leftists just turn up to sort of mock her, as far as I can work out. It's very cruel.
You get some of the most extraordinarily unfunny people, catastrophically unfunny people, like Sophie Duker, who said "kill Whitey" on TV. And you're watching, I get some people send me clips. I don't ever watch any comedy now, but occasionally Leo will basically send me a clip of something really bad. I'll be watching it, and it's just cringe-inducingly. It's not that it's not funny. It's a horrific car crash of just cringe-inducing horror. But on the sports analogy, that's the one area it hasn't dominated or taken over, except you could argue the very existence of women's football and the fact we're all supposed to like it. But they're currently still not allowed to play with the men, Ed. Someone tried to own me on Twitter with a really half-witted comment. So only white men are capable of anything. Why don't you all dominate in sports? Are all the sports players DEI too? It's like, basically, the analogy is if you had the NBA and it was suddenly all had to be 5-foot white women, and then so they'd have to lower the net, no one would watch it. It would be absolutely awful. But that would be the equivalent as if they put DEI in sports. Like, hang on, why is it all massive black guys? Where are the white disabled lesbians?
Well, there's some evidence that they did put DEI in sport, didn't they? In the was it the 2021 World Cup final? World Cup semi-final? It was generally felt that the manager of England was under pressure because of the context in which it was in, George Floyd, whatever, to put up in the penalty shootout black players who were not particularly good at taking penalties.
You think that's why Southgate put them on? I'm not sure about that.
That's what was suggested at the time. Certainly it was suggested that these were relatively obscure players. These were players that weren't, you know, that well-known, weren't that good. He didn't have to use those
Rashford
people.
Was well-known. I think it was just terrible management. But I don't, I take your point. I'm not sure. I don't know what was in. Southgate's definitely woke. There's no doubt about that. The next level will be women on the pitch with the men. The sport's just so big money, they just haven't quite done it there. It's the most elite thing that we have left in our culture, the most meritocratic, brutally competitive. But of course, on a global scale, that means you just import the best players from around the world. But just on the sports analogy again, in comedy, the other thing was, and this is covered very much in the piece as well, the older white men stayed in their place. And I've always said it's like if you were in the football team and you were Harry Kane trying to get through, but Gary Lineker was still in the team from 1990 and he's still in the as the main striker. It's like that. You still had like Hugh Dennis on the telly. And so when I got my stupid thing in 2021, where I basically had enough and I just said, isn't this ridiculous? And someone had sent me we talked about this before, but had sent me a thing saying you can't have this gig because you're a straight white man. And I just took all their identifying information out and just shared it I just thought this will be funny. And I said, I dream of a day when I can be judged on the content of my content, not the content of my content, something like that. This blew up and it got into the papers and it ended up in the Telegraph and the Mail and the Jeremy Vine Show and all these things. And people like Jason Manford piled on me. And his argument, and I'd always been really nice to him, his argument was, well, how come white men... And he listed a load of white men, most of whom were established in the 90s. It's people like Alan Davis and all this. So it's like he was dunking on me from his position of enormous wealth and privilege and just saying, hang on, we're still here. It's like, yeah, I'm aware that you're still there. And this was very much in the piece.
The whole thing is total hypocrisy. You have in academia or whatever, you have them saying, we need more women in STEM. You'll have men, male white professors saying, well, we need more women in STEM or whatever it happens to be. Okay. You're right. You may well be correct about that. I don't know. I mean, let's assume your ideology is correct and you should not be judged by your ability, but by the fact that you're a minority or whatever. Fine. Well, then obviously, unless you resign and ensure there is one fewer white man in STEM and open up a place for a woman, then That's just virtue signaling, isn't it? That's just hollow. That's extremely easy to do. It's very easy to do. Oh, yeah, I think there should be more. Well, resign. Oh, no, they'll come up with a counter argument. Oh, no, no, I want to stay in place so I can help bring about a structure where there are more women and more minorities in STEM. Well, what kind of an argument is that? That clearly you're just socially signaling. No, you leave, you resign. And you won't do that. You won't do that, of course, because you want to optimally help your career. How do you help your career? You carry on with your career as it is. You're making money, but you socially signal that you're in with the current morality, and therefore you find that some manipulative way to stay in your place. And you get this absolutely everywhere. So therefore, the result is, as you say, an older generation who virtue signal about this and come back with what are actually manipulative and fallacious arguments, i.e., oh, well, look at this person. Look, white men can easily get into comedy. Look at Stuart Lee. Right, when did he get in? Late 80s. White men can easily get into comedy. Look at Jeremy Carr. When did Carr, what's his name? Jimmy Carr. When did he get in? He was actually quite a young starter, born 75, but he was quite a young starter, got in before it all changed. Although in his defence, he doesn't go on about this and say that there need to be more women in comedy.
One thing they started doing was allowing you to be writers for a diversity, and the white people could be writers at the back. But what you're talking about is so perfectly exemplified by this piece that I remember bothering me, and Toby Young wrote about it here, the BBC's anti-white rhetoric. There's a very strange thing that Cassian Harrison, the editor of BBC Four, told the Edinburgh International Television Festival, and this was in 2018, there's a mode of programming that involves a presenter, usually white, middle-aged and male, standing on a hill and telling you like it is. We all recognize the era of that has passed. You're like, okay, cheers, Cassian. It's like, so it's exactly what he's saying, right? It's over for the old white men. And it's also over, as implied, for any newer white man. But it's going to be some bloke called Cassian who's still keeping his job while putting on a load of sort of urban programming about drill music or something. It's so
putting on some history documentary where the person that is telling you about it is some woman that is going to be mainly judged by her boobs. There's various TV historians of this type that are about 5 years or so older than me. I can't think of the names of them off the top of my head, but because they're obviously there because they're youngish. Well, not even young anymore, but when they started, they were youngish and women. And that's why they're there. And I think to myself, oh, I'd love to watch a documentary about Lady Jane Grey. That'd be really interesting. It's presenting new information about Lady Jane Grey. Great. But it won't be hosted by a man. And it won't even be hosted by a female historian who's actually good and has done the research, like this Leander Delisle woman that's recently done a lot of interesting research on Lady Jane Grey and showed that film in Helena Bonham Carter to be complete rubbish. No, it'll be hosted by some Dolly Bird historian. I can't remember what their names are, but you just can't really take. They're all the same vacuous, you know, that you can't really take very seriously. So it undermines their credibility. It undermines the person that's presenting the information has to have credibility. They don't necessarily have to be a man. I mean, they could be a woman, but let's face it, they're generally probably going to be more likely to be a man. And this is taken away.
And one thing it's done is push people into things like this, where we have to somehow scrap around for money. And by the way, on that subject, we should be getting super chats. I suddenly thought, Ed, if we're jointly sharing this, can we not get super chats? That's the only conceivable reason I can think why people haven't put loads of super chats in, that because we're jointly sharing it, maybe it doesn't work. I have no idea. It's an experiment.
No. I've jointly shared with other people. People do send in super chats.
So they're just not doing it. Okay. So the reason I mention that is because this is what happened. So this was very much about this piece again. And this person on Twitter says, it's no coincidence that alt media, YouTube, podcasting, and Substack all took off right at the peak of DEI. Nor is it a coincidence that these fields are heavily dominated by white men. They're essentially banished from academia, media, and corporate America as a matter of explicit policy. So they had to create new outlets from scratch. And that is exactly what has happened. That's why we're all here. They've made us all incredibly based, as you said to me in a message. They didn't do it like they've created a monster. They've created even more of a monster, which is the next generation of Zoomers who don't care at all. But we had to go and do this. We sort of live as you get used to it. You're sort of living like an outlaw. You don't even think about it anymore after a while. But it's a very different way of life. You've got to sort of your normal life is derailed, or what you could have planned. And of course, you can't in an area like comedy, you're not owed a living or anything like that. But you saw constantly, even on the club level, it was constantly, we want a woman for this role, blah, blah, blah. So it was basically the old rules, the old, you couldn't make money anymore. And when that happens, you can't necessarily have a family. This happened to loads of people in these pieces. They delayed having a family and then you don't have children. So this actually stopped people being born. When I talk about it as the white menace, this actually stopped people being born. But the other thing is they went into doing things like we're doing now, Ed.
Yes.
What effect? What does that have? That changes the culture completely. Lastly, they still say, oh, it's a load of white men with beards doing podcasts. Like, it's the last thing we're allowed to do because we've done it completely ourselves. And now you're still annoyed. You want us to starve.
Yeah, you could argue if you wanted to be, I don't know, really charitable about it, which I don't want to be because it makes me very angry that white middle class men have been not even white middle class because they don't need to do anything for white working class chaps, do they? So it's just white men have been treated in this way, and it's extremely unfair. And we have there's this absolute bollockhead who tweeted earlier. Steve Saylor wrote, "You'd have a better writing job too if you were a black woman." And someone called Malcolm Harris, who has pronouns in his bio, has written, "Important to teach children to ignore the lying bigot demons who whisper appeals to their worst nature, so their jealousy and laziness, and self pity." Right. So he's saying basically, Steve Saylor is mentally ill. If you believe Steve Saylor, you're mentally ill. You're crazy. You're possessed by Satan. It is your worst nature. So from what I can work out, just tell the empirical truth. And if you tell the empirical truth, you're jealous and you're lazy and you're indulging in self-pity. Right. That is the fallacy, as anyone that knows anything about anything would know, of just appeal to insult. It's highly manipulative because that's all they've got. What he's saying is true. But to be charitable, you would say, for example, Ben Johnson argued he puts restrictions on himself. He does his plays according to Aristotelian norms, which William Shakespeare doesn't. So he has these restrictions, which Shakespeare doesn't. And this forces him to be more creative. If you've got restrictions, you are compelled to be more creative. And as a consequence, you may well end up doing things that are actually better. Now, most people would argue Shakespeare is better than Ben Johnson, so perhaps that was a bad analogy. but you know what I mean. And so that's what has basically happened to a generation of white men. We've been, in my case, as originally an academic, we've been excluded from mainstream academia. Both because of being white and male, but also, let's face it, because of it's my own fault because of being based. Although that, as I'll come to that in a minute, because that's not a coincidence. And so we're forced to be creative. We're forced to come up with our own platforms. YouTube restricts us. Patreon restricts us. So what do we end up with? There's an area in the market. You end up with Substack, and it has really taken off, and it is helping to create really a kind of para academia. And a kind of alternative elite, almost a rival elite, which is very dangerous for society to have rival elites. But that's what it's done, and we've been forced into that situation. And a similar situation. The only comparison that comes to mind in academia is what was going on in the 19th century. If you were a dissenter, if you were a nonconformist, as which some of the cleverest people were, then you couldn't go to the English universities. You couldn't attend the English universities. You couldn't teach at the English universities. So what they ended up establishing, well, they'd either go to Scotland, and then Scotland was recognised as the place where science was, the place where the sensible research was, the place where the cleverest kids actually went. They didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge or Durham. And then the dissenting academies, like Warrington Academy, for example, and there were many of them. And Warrington is the best example. Warrington's where oxygen was discovered. You got people that were Anglican, That like, for example, Thomas Malthus's parents, that sent their kids to dissenting academies because it was generally understood that the quality of education and the thing that would be better at a dissenting academy than at the traditional universities, because then the excluded intelligent people would set these places up, and then they were had these restrictions or whatever, which made them work hard and be more creative, and they come up with brilliant stuff, and then people want to go there. So that's what they've done. They've shot themselves in their own. I was going to say testicles, but you know what I mean. In their manginas.
You can't say the anatomically correct word.
In my case, I asked myself this: would I have got the plan was go to university? What am I going to do? Don't know. Be an academic. Did a PhD, and then the idea is you get a job as an academic. Had I got a job as a full-time academic in the UK, which I almost did twice, would I have just stayed in the UK and played the game? I like to think not, but I seriously think I may have done. And I knew about this based stuff. I knew about it. I was aware of it. I've been aware of it since I was a teenager. But the social pressure and the need to repress that knowledge and not talk about it was very, very strong. And of course, once they took away that pressure, once there was just nothing to lose, basically. And then you start getting into other things like Richard Lynn and so on, and then if you can get money out of it, then off you go.
Yes, well, by the way, some people have now put in super chats, so thank you very much. I'll read them in a bit. I just want to say, Ed, on some of those points you made, would one have done it? Yes, I could never have gone along with woke anyway. There's different levels of playing the game. I have friends who hate it from comedy who just sort of go along with it. I don't really speak to them anymore. Like I say, you have people who, particularly disreputable, is people I know who posted the black square. Do you remember the black square when everyone had to post the black square when Black Lives Matter, when the unfortunate American criminal overdosed in America 2020, everyone was posting a black square to show solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And if you didn't post this square in the comedy industry, this was like noted. And anyone who posted a square was disgusting. But the worst were the people I knew who were completely against the square, but they posted the square anyway. And I'm like, I can't really be friends with people like that. So that was a real problem. So yeah, how far can you go along with it? I would never have gone along with it. You can always tell who's quasi against this kind of thing anyway, which I'm sure the powers that be could tell. But on your point, Ed, about sort of would you have stayed in things, I often think about it's just the chance that you wanted. All you're asking for as a straight white man is the opportunity. All you want is a brutal merit-based world where you can just test your mettle. That's all you're asking for. So when you say, it's like playing that cup game, right, that they play in the street in American movies, but there's nothing under any of the cups, then you're insane to keep playing the game. If there was just one thing under one cup, you think, okay, I could probably work this out, right? But it came to a position in comedy where there's nothing. They're telling you can't have anything. You can't have an agent. You can't have anything explicitly because of your immutable characteristics. So you're a fool to kind of carry on. And even then you carry on for a while thinking, well, maybe something will happen. You know what I mean? But you're just like, well, this is completely pointless. And that's not the only reason I left comedy. It's also just a venal, disgusting cesspit full of uncreative drone-like scum. But it was one of the reasons. And by the way, why is it that... Matt Walsh had a really interesting thing I might just share, because he pointed out that when they did this, the knock-on effect was so massive just because the people they put in just weren't as good. I thought maybe we could have a look at this, see what you think.
The biggest and most important downstream consequence of this open discrimination against white men is that everything in society gets worse as a result. That is the second order effect that the compact piece doesn't really get into. It's the third rail, the part you're not supposed to talk about. The truth, which everybody intuitively knows, is that things were a lot better back when white men were not being discriminated against by every institution in the country, but instead were running most of them. And the fact of the matter is that a hugely disproportionate number of our greatest leaders, innovators, pioneers, explorers, philosophers, and so on, have been white men. I mean, without white men, we wouldn't have airplanes or spaceships or trains or phones or light bulbs or computers or the internet or batteries or x-ray machines or jet engines or rockets or 1,000 other things that our society depends on to exist and to flourish. We never would have had a railway system or the printing press.
Living in caves.
We have a country which was founded by white men and led by white men and expanded from coast to coast and settled and built up mostly by white men. Now, these are all facts, historical realities that cannot be denied by reasonable people. It's just true. And while Black women are encouraged to be proud of the historical achievements of Black women, whatever those might be, and Asians to be proud of Asian achievements and Native Americans of Native American achievements and so on, white men are the one group in the entire face of the planet who've been forbidden to even acknowledge what other white men have accomplished.
All right. Don't know, it's a whole Matt Walsh show, but it was just an interesting clip. That is quite interesting. It's pretty obviously true, isn't it? There's a good tweet I'll find later about the sort of second and third order effects of this. It's had repercussions throughout society. It said that people had less children. It also meant that women were pushed into roles and therefore they probably would have raised children and didn't. the number of sort of downstream effects.
And also women being one of the things that's noticeable in academia is that women are sexually select, of course, for status. They sexually select hypergamously from themselves. So they want men that have higher social status than themselves. Now, in humanities, where women are dominant, then there's very, very few men that have higher status than themselves, with the result that there's nobody for them to be sexually attracted to. And so they become cat ladies or lesbians. And so it infertilizes them in that way. So it's just against the evolutionary order of things. Men are evolved. If you look, there's a very interesting book, I always recommend it to people, by Joyce Benenson, called Warriors and Warriors, O&A, Warriors and Warriors. And she looks at the different psychologies of men and women, particularly in relation to friendships, and notes that men, a la Simon Baron Cohen, they're about truth, they're about how things work, they're about systems and whatever, and they're not particularly interested in empathy. And a big part of being friends with someone is collaborating with them over abilities that are complementary, in order to achieve something, because we're evolved to be part of an army. Like for example, Nick is obviously more kind of academically minded than me, but I'm funnier. And yeah. so they complement, right? And so
annoyingly,
and so
you are funny, but that's annoying. But I also got a master's in English, so I've got a little bit of both.
Well, you've got the best history A level in the world, apparently.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that in a minute, but actually, good point. Go on. Not that specifically.
But there's that, right? But whereas with women, it's very, very different, she argues. And it's not about forming an army. It's not about talent. It's about, with a limited degree it is, but it's about finding allo parents for your children, because you are evolved to be part of a harem, and you need other women to help you. So you have a small clique of allo parents who you foster to look after your children. And that has to be based around complete equality and total trust. And what is anathema to them is any kind of social discord. And of course, new ideas, genius, academia, coming up with new stuff, right, involves offending people, it involves an argument, it involves a fight. And they're not evolved. They don't want social discord, not least because they're physically weak and could be killed and they have babies to protect. So they don't want social discord. And so they will create a situation. There was an interesting study I found recently which found that women will be less... if you're a woman and you dissent, let's say you're on the extreme left, and you go and present your ideas to centre-left women, those women will be more intolerant of you than very right-wing men will be, even though you're on a leftist like them. So that's how intolerant they are. On average, of course, there are exceptions like Amy Wax or whatever. That's how intolerant they are of these kinds of stereotypically masculine notions of conflict and the system, I'm saying systems being more important than other things, and the truth being more important than other things, and the idea of something based around talent where inherently there's conflict and there's rivalry. They're very and so there's a completely different mindset. And when and that is why men are the overwhelming majority. This is so overwhelming of innovators. Yeah. We have a broader IQ range than they do, which means you have more outliers in intelligence. We have higher psychopathy than they do, which when combined with a very high intelligence is where genius comes from. I scoffed when he was talking. I said, oh God, we'd still be living in caves if it wasn't for these kinds of men. It would be worse than that. We wouldn't have entered the caves. I mean, we entered the caves because the Earth's magnetic field collapsed and we all started getting sunburn. And then we started wearing ochre and stuff to protect our skins. And then we went into the caves to protect ourselves from the terrible, you know, carcinogenic sun's rays. I would imagine that a lot of women at the time would have opposed doing that because it was changed.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the other thing, Ed. I tweeted the other day, white people are the world's most precious resource. Really, everyone else should be working to allow us to sit around and think up cool inventions and art. Instead, they want to wipe us out and return to trying to make fire with sticks or whatever, which is kind of what you're referring to there. Let me just reply to some of what you said. Helen Andrews is very good on this, on the feminization of society, because this is happening against the backdrop of an already totally feminized society. So one could argue DEI is only the final blow, even though it is a massive blow. You already had, I mean, it was an expansion of the HR culture as well, alongside it, I suppose, concomitantly, but you already had a feminized society that was against the kind of traits you're talking about in general. And not only that, you had an egalitarian society, which is the same thing, partly. And even C.S. Lewis is onto this in Screwtape Proposes a Toast, which I was reading the other day. I think that's from 1959. It's an addendum to the original Screwtape Letters. And he has a long screed in that about how education has become all about, oh, I'm just as good as you. So it's become about a strange lowest common denominator kind of egalitarianism, which anyone from a state school will recognize. One example was we were doing business studies. Only six of us passed the module exam. So they just put the whole class through the exam again, and we were just left to get on with whatever. So it was always a pandering to the thickos. And C.S. Lewis talks about this. In Screwtape Proposes a Toast, he even links it to the devil, and because that Screwtape is from the narrated by a devil. So it's like this backdrop, DEI, yes, is the sort of final frontier, but we already had egalitarianism. We already had the decline of the grammar schools, sort of anti-selective policies. We already had a HR workplace. Wasn't the whole culture already sort of stacked against male achievement?
Yeah, it was. And we've just made it considerably worse. But the thing is, we've made it so bad now that it used to be that you might overpromote at a middle level, but you'd realize, well, you can't overpromote at the highest levels. That's just going to cause really serious problems. But it creates a runaway virtue signaling system whereby eventually you're overpromoting unsuitable people at the highest levels. And then it's really dangerous. And this was noticed with the wildfires in Los Angeles at the beginning. Was it the beginning of 24 or the beginning of this, beginning of whatever it was, right? That you had all these women in charge of firefighting, which surely is a traditionally male profession because you've got to be physically able and strong and stuff. But anyway, all these women in charge of firefighting, and they've evidently made all kinds of extremely poor decisions. And that's not necessarily because they're women. It's because they were promoted because they were women. I.e. they weren't the best people for the job. The best people for the job were not promoted. And this is now because they've promoted them to such high levels, this problem is now being seen much more frequently, as recently as 2 days ago. Now, come on. Why on earth was Sarah Mullally appointed Archbishop of Canterbury? She was appointed, or indeed Bishop of London. She was appointed. She doesn't even have a doctorate in theology. Normally, bishops almost have a doctorate in theology. Doesn't have that. But for some reason, she was appointed. She was appointed because she is a woman. That is why she was appointed. And there would have been men who would have been more qualified and better than her at doing that kind of job who were passed over so she could do it. Then, just to rub people's noses in it, just to rub the noses of the evangelicals in it, they appoint her Archbishop of Canterbury. She hasn't been enthroned yet, by the way. She's just been announced. And now it comes to light that when she was Bishop of London, there was a report which levelled all kinds of allegations that were false and were just rumours that were just nasty against all kinds of innocent people. And she didn't read that. And then there was a report about that report, and she didn't read it properly, and she didn't really do anything about it, and she didn't do what she told people. Yeah, I know you're not in the report, but then she admitted she hadn't read the report. So he said, well, how on earth do you know that I'm not in the report then? And eventually, as a result of her negligence, a priest killed himself. And now there are serious people saying that this enthronement needs to be stopped. Wow. And that somebody else needs to be appointed Archbishop of Canterbury. So that's the kind of thing that happens if you get DEI. People die.
People die. And the other notable example was, of course, Trump, who nearly died. And with the female Secret Service, who were too small, didn't jump in the way. Famous photographs of that. So it could have literally got leader of the free world killed. DEI. And of course, there was the plane that crashed. You mentioned the wildfires. So yeah, DEI literally kills.
You can't have confidence in things. So you
right.
Literally
trust is gone. Thinking,
I've got this doctor here. Has this doctor, who's a senior doctor, who's a consultant, got here on merit or not? Mm. And realistically, yeah. If they're a woman or a minority, then maybe not.
I described it as a massive decline in quality, the erosion of trust, and the stoking of immense resentment. I think I nailed it. Yes, trust is gone. There's resentment. It's dangerous. It's unbelievable. I mean, let's look at this on the sort of second and third and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth order effect, which I thought put it well from Vittorio on Twitter. X. The thing about calling DEI economic genocide is that it undersells it. I don't know if you can say that word on YouTube. Yes, young white men were systematically excluded from careers during their peak marriage years, but that's just first order effects. Second order, marriage market collapse, women date across and up, as you said, Ed Hypergamous. Men without careers become invisible to the women who would have married them and disappear. The eligible bachelor pool shrinks. Third order, fertility crisis, fewer marriages, fewer children. But it's worse than just men not marrying or having families. The women who won the DEI lottery got careers instead of families, delayed fertility until it was too late. That's something I mentioned earlier. Fourth order, psychological. Young men couldn't even name what was happening to them. Right, absolutely. I mean, how many, we don't know how many men have killed themselves because of this. I'm amazed. I said in the tweet, I'm amazed more millennial men aren't killing themselves or just punching people in the post office queue.
That's why this Jacob Savage guy should get the blokish equivalent of a knighthood or something, because he's named it. It's a breakthrough moment, a bit like with COVID and whatever that guy was called that just went for it and said, "Hang on, what's going on here?" That British guy.
I was going to say all the grooming gangs, when that suddenly broke, when Elon Musk shared it, even though it was long after the fact. This is how this feels to me.
It does feel like that. He's named it. We're realizing that we've been abused. All the people that reveal what was going on in Irish mother and baby homes or whatever. They've named it. They've put a label on it. They've given us data. They've given us statistics. And we can understand what it is that our generation have been through, just as much as it can be understood what these girls have been through in Rotherham and Rochdale and so forth. Name it, state what it is, state in detail, in depth, what's happened, so that everyone can understand what it is. And go in detail. I think that's a very good point. In the full potential consequences of this, which is just utter devastation and wreckage and carnage of so many lives, and the insane closing of doors, or at least the very much, you know, on so much talent, and the damage that does to society. From, you might think, from things ranging from academic research to just making people laugh on a Friday evening, whatever it is, and it's so bad, and it's I think it's wonderful the way that this Jacob Savage chap, I've never heard of. I wonder if he's related to Macho Man Randy Savage, who was of that generation when you got the job of being a
got the job
because you were good at wrestling.
You were good at wrestling and saying, "Ooh, yeah, exactly." The shame, Ed, is part of what's kept it down. The shame of you weren't supposed to mention it, and if you did, you were like attacked a total loser. When I finally did mention it in 2021, I didn't care anymore. The attacks I got from the comedy industry were unbelievable, like bitter. He's just shit at comedy. Most of this was from older white men, of course, not exclusively. Just shit at comedy, bitter, and that's what you're going to get. And that's a big feature of the article as well. It's like you don't want to mention it because you don't want to sound lame or bitter or something. And he goes on, young men couldn't even name what was happening to them. Complaining was proof of weakness, exactly as I said. They internalized failure as personal inadequacy rather than systemic rigging. Fifth order, institutional trust gone, which we've touched on that. Once you know positions are filled by demographics rather than competence, every credential becomes suspect, if not a priori worthless. Sixth order, reality becomes unspeakable. Noticing any of this was a fireable offense. Exactly. Pointing out the obvious got you called a bigot, deplatformed or fired. Yes, can confirm. Seventh order, the feedback loop. Fewer eligible men means more women competing for a shrinking pool. More women losing the marriage market. More resentment. More men are trash. More support for DEI. Fewer eligible men, and the system accelerates itself. And the worst part is that DEI was just the economic arm. The same people and institutions pushed the complete package. Toxic masculinity to pathologize male identity. The future is female. It's explicit zero-sum framing delusion. Believe all women. Men are trash, etc. So that he nails it there. But check out
What does it do to the generation? We weren't brought up with this. We weren't brought up with this. It manifested when we were in manifested in a very obvious way when we were in our early 30s or whatever. So what does it do to a generation that are born in the late 90s that are brought up with just being? And then that's the next order effect, which is that they will rebel. That with our generation, it's just like this thing that gradually happens to us, and we get used to it slowly, like a boiling frog. With that generation, they are told from as young as they can remember, this is the way it is. Your teacher's got purple hair. She cuts her arm because she's sad.
You're evil because you're a white man.
You're evil because you're white. And the result, obviously, is that's the new Christianity. That's what we were brought up at the tail end of, a sort of a conservative Christian society. Grandparents fought in the Second World War, that kind of thing. You rebel against that, like Daria or whatever, as AA puts it. they rebel against this, and they are doing so. So then this emboldens people like us who are a bit older, who've kind of shut up about it a bit, to then think, oh God, well, there's going to be people that will back us up, and so we can come out and I suppose I did though. I mean, me personally and you as well. We went for it quite early, just thought, bugger it. But there's other people who, because we're like actually brave and not cowards. But there are people that aren't as brave as me and Nick.
Like almost everyone.
I won't name him, but you've worked with some of these people.
That have
come out later and done some quite interesting and important things, actually. Really, but we're much more cautious about going for it. But then, so then you get this snowball effect where the old combine with the young to overtake this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for me, partly during lockdown, I sort of thought, oh, sorry, I'll just say what I want to say, which started out just being writing in Spiked, which now seems very tame because Spiked now hate me because I'm too right wing. But yeah, I started then and just thought, sorry, I'd already said something. And then I just went all out. And eventually you're talking to Ed Dutton and there's literally no further to go. But it's funny, Ed, what you said just reminded me of my quite angry, admittedly, post. I said reading this article is reminding me how evil the so-called DEI project was. For my generation of white male millennials, the enemy made sure we couldn't have careers, hence no money or stability. And for many, that meant no family. Thus, the aim was to break millions of white men, but also to stop future generations ever being born. To Zoomers who were born into this charred and blackened landscape, the bodies of white male millennials were stacked high as a warning to abandon all hope. Yet somehow Zoomers began to rise up. The millennials have been blindsided by a new weapon. They were shamed into silence. And if they ever did speak out, they were ridiculed and cancelled, another powerful new weapon. But the Zoomers had the benefit of watching this play out or hearing it in the tales of the past. They also had nothing to lose. When they launched their attack, the enemy stared at them and said, but you're supposed to be dead. We killed you. But they had underestimated the spirit and genius of the people they were trying to erase. Any white male millennials still roaming these ravaged plains should join with the Zoomers in total war against the forces that have taken everything from us and have almost destroyed Western civilization in the process. We should show them the same lack of mercy. This article clearly reveals they showed
to us. Yes, that's one thing that I comment. I had some
not physical violence, of course.
Saying, look, this is changing, this is shifting, but no, you know, we need to be sensible, we need to be reasonable, and if you as a white man react in any way to what's now being revealed, then you're just as bad as the woke have done it. No. That is that what you are saying is forgive and forget and allow the ultimately still woke elite, white woke elite that have done this to us to just get away with it and pusillanimously change their minds and say, oh, yeah, I'm anti-woke now, like Piers Morgan or whatever. Oh, I'm anti-woke. No, there must be vengeance.
Yes,
there must be. It must be like when Queen Mary came to the throne and burnt Thomas Cranmer at the stake. It must be like that.
But because we're in Starmer's Britain, we'll have to clarify. I wrote, of course, I'm not talking about physical violence. This is a spiritual, cultural, and political war that is more profound than the merely material. Our anger must be channeled into wiping the scum that did this out of all existence forever with no apology or hesitation. Of course, evil will take on new forms, but this manifestation must be obliterated once and for all. I just wanted to get that in, Ed, in case Starmer
One of the forms of evil that it may take on, if as things swing to the right, is then you're going to get like the right-wing purity signaler that goes too far and is competitively condemning other people because they've, you know, had an illegitimate child or had sex outside marriage. That's what I'm banking on. No. that would just be as bad, but in a different way. They need to be completely driven out of public life, like people that were communists under the GDR were in 1989 or whatever. They need to be completely removed, punished, and so forth out.
What do you think it looks like? Because Dan from Lotus Eaters has been kind enough to put in a super chat and say, this has gone so far, all these institutions will fall and we will build new ones. Our generational lesson must be to not let those ones be infiltrated all over again. So what does it look like? Is it what we're, and I'll read the other chats in a minute, but what does it look like? What we're already doing with building the things like Lotus Eaters, for example?
Yeah, building
Carl alternative institutions. Carl and Dan do great work.
And as they are, and as I was saying with the dissenting academies, wokeness has gone so far that it turns us, I mean, I don't know if it's a good analogy, but I did look at this in my book, Woke Eugenics, like it turns us all in a way into fundamentalists. in the sense that fundamentalists, evangelical Christians, whatever, they have this feeling of being, you know, in the world but not of the world, that the world is mad, the world is crazy, and they're the only sane ones and that understand what's going on. They have this feeling of being excluded and not part of the mainstream. And it's forced more and more people to feel like that. Once you start having compelled speech, you tell people you have to tell a delusional narcissist, you have to partake in their fantasy or be prosecuted. You're pushing more and more people that have any kind of self-respect into this alternative realm, into these alternative, these counter-elites or whatever you want to call them, with their own institutions, things like the Lotus Eaters or whatever. And you're increasingly pushing more and more intelligent people who are more conformist, by intelligent people on average. But as you really go for it, you're pushing them in. And eventually those institutions become just better than the original institutions, because you've excluded all of the, there's a degree to which, not completely, but there's a degree to which you've excluded a lot of the best people from the original institutions. And people don't seem to understand. They seem to think, what's the word? They seem to reify things. So they seem to think that Oxford and Cambridge are just brilliant, and Durham and London and Edinburgh and these kinds of places, right? These posh universities where posh people go. They are good universities. That's the nature of them. They don't seem to understand. No, they're seen as prestigious universities because of who goes there. Who goes there? Posh people, and people want to go where posh people go. Durham University, where I went in the 50s or 40s, was not considered a prestigious university. It wasn't. It was just a university. It became prestigious because suddenly they started rejecting, they started being selective with Oxford and Cambridge, not just letting you in because of the school you'd been to. So suddenly you have these posh people that are Oxford rejects. They want to go somewhere like Oxford. Where do they go? Durham, similar university, some kind of structure, right? And that's when it became posh. Ditto St. Andrews. So it's not an inherent quality. And so if you change the nature of the people that are associated with it, you change the degree to which it is prestigious. There was once a time where going to Oxford and Cambridge was less prestigious than going to Glasgow or Edinburgh. That's a fact, right? There was once a time where that's the case. And so that's what they're doing. People are gradually realizing, I'm not going to fuck about watching TV. You know, I'll watch the Lotus Eaters at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, finish time. And this is a slow process, but it's what's happening. Think prestige is where the talent is, and so if you say, and where the sort of, I guess for a better word, poshness is, and if you change that, then eventually the institution is not worth very much, and it dies.
Yeah, and you couldn't have a much better example than the young man who celebrated the death of Charlie Kirk. He got into Oxford on an ABB, obviously a complete idiot in pretty much every way, and he's now the face of Oxford Union and was president-elect. And you go, okay, that is an institution that has fallen. Yes, because there's nothing magical about the building, just like there's nothing, even though the buildings are nice, just like there's nothing magical about our soil that transforms people from completely different cultures. I just want to say something about the circulation of elites as well. People talk about elite theory, and one thing that makes an elite too brittle is a failure to circulate in new talents is a classic thing. And sometimes there's this overproduction of elites is one theory as well, that when there's too many, what can you do with them? But this has really been deliberate. I'm not sure it's an overproduction. It's a deliberate excluding of elite talent or potential elite talent. One interesting example I was thinking of is, in a way, what this has done is create Nick Fuentes. Lots of people will be using that example. I've already seen it in the chat. It's created the Nick Fuentes of the world. And I think an interesting point is his meeting with Trump. It's possible to imagine a world. So Fuentes went to meet Trump with Kanye and Milo's. It was kind of an absurd kind of situation, but Trump didn't know who Fuentes was. So he went, hey, who's this kid? He's a smart cookie. Hey, I like this kid. He started saying how he likes him. He's smart, because Fuentes is reeling off stats and political opinions, because he can do that as well as just make edgy jokes. Trump loves this guy. But after the meeting, he has to disavow him because of who he is. Now, of course, it's changing a little bit, where Fuentes has managed to, against all odds, edge his way into something like the mainstream. At the time, he still hadn't. It was three years ago, 2022, because I wrote an article about it. So in a different world, though, even though it's hard to imagine in this world, Fuentes is kind of accepted in, and he gets a job with the Trump administration, and then he tones it down a bit, and he's kind of accepted in. That was the healthy thing. But now they didn't choose that. They chose this other thing. It's like, okay, you wanted to create, it's kind of like a Joker moment. It's like, you created me. It's like, all right, you could have had that, but you no, of course he's beyond the pale. But so much is beyond the pale. Fuentes is the more extreme end, but everything's beyond the pale. And just being a white man is beyond the pale. So it's like, okay, good luck. You've just created a far more extreme generation. And just on that note, JD Vance has even commented on this article. He says a lot of people think... Go on.
Yeah. Sorry, when you say far more extreme generation, yeah, this is a very good point, which is worth fleshing out. So once you exclude people, as they have, all these people that are in our circles and whatever, compelling them to, exclude so many of them, and so many of them, in many cases, that have resources and connections and talent, then this, of course, permits the creation of a counter elite and of counter institutions such as Substack, and now Twitter, from which they can obtain a living and whatever. You create that, you force that, you've brought that about, but via your exclusionary extremism of being an extreme, mentally ill, insecure leftist. But then, unfortunately, that's the extremism thing. Once you do that, then you have an echo chamber, you're within that echo chamber, and you socially signal within that echo chamber. So just as the left moves more and more left and becomes more and more intolerant over the years via competitive virtue signaling, you get this on the right, and then you get to the point where competitively purity signaling, as it were, or competitively baseness signaling, should we call it, and you get to the point where you have someone like Fuentes, who has a substantial following. I don't know about the quality of the following, but it's a substantial following, just saying, yeah, Hitler was a cool dude, and just deliberately going so far as the unthinkable, baseless signaling. So you make that other side more extreme.
Well, I was going to say, what was really interesting about that clip about saying the painter is cool is when you watch him explain that further in a clip, although, of course, it's a shocking thing to say, it's taboo busting. When he explains it, it very much explains his entire generation. He says, imagine you've grown up, told you're evil, every baddie is evil, you're evil for being a white man, you've got a cower, you can't do anything, it's all over for you. He's like, whereas those clips of the sort of the painter and other people, to him, they represented an unapologetic stance. It's not actually connected with the real historical figure and the atrocities. Yeah. It's just, this is what it's like to be a man and not be apologizing for your entire existence. That's what it meant to him.
Yeah, and also by saying that, it's an FU to those that are dominating you. It's saying, I don't care. I want to offend you. I will assert power over you. I will shock you. And that will make me feel better about myself, and it will make me feel in control, and it will change things. It will inspire others to not care. The Hitler taboo and other such taboos are a symbol of their power. They are what they use to assert they have moral power and they should be in charge, and it's what they use to manipulate you and cower you, because you don't want to be accused of being that thing. That's why the word racist is so powerful. It associates you with the Holocaust or Hitler or whatever. But if you don't care about that, if you just reject that, even though you don't necessarily think Hitler was a great guy, you just rise above it. I don't care. Call me racist. I don't care. And you can be back, and you know you'll be backed up by others, and it won't destroy you. That's when they're in serious trouble. And that's why Piers Morgan was so shocked by that, because that implies that his whole thing that he's invested in by the younger generation is in trouble.
Yes, and they've been, I said this to Carl and Lotzi, is they could have been so much more avuncular. People like Finkelstein, I understand why he would be upset, but he could have done it better. Morgan could have, and even Jordan Peterson, I know he's ill at the moment, but he called Fuentes a rat on Twitter. And you're like, why are you this champion of young men so threatened that you're calling a young man a rat? It's like, no, ask him why he's like that. Say, what's your take? Why has this happened? That's the thing to do if you want to rescue it. But they didn't. They just doubled down, you're evil. But now there's a whole generation going, well, we can't all be evil. It's just not plausible. And we seem like nice enough people. We have, we're polite and well turned out. This is not plausible that all these people are evil. So that's not working anymore. And as I said, it's even reached JD Vance, which I was just going to share just out of interest. Just the fact that he's commented on this article. A lot of people think DEI is lame, diversity seminars or racial slogans at NFL games. In reality, it was a deliberate program of discrimination primarily against white men. This is an incredible piece that describes the evil of DEI and its consequences. And even he goes on to say the Trump administration is trying to do something about it, eliminate your funding for DEI, required government grants to certify they're not engaged in DEI, fired a number of DEI employees. And He says so much of this was generational. Older white men created a system whereby they'd be fine, but millennials and Gen Z would be screwed. Cowardice and evil are a deadly combination. Pretty interesting for him to say that. I might add in a minute, some Gen X people actually, to be fair, maybe I'll just quickly add this now, to be very fair, because I just saw someone in Gen X say that they've been dealing with this their whole life as well, the lies. Scott Adams, same everywhere in corporate America for at least three decades. And he's said a lot of times this happened to him in his career. Mike Cernovich, this started a long time ago. My dad didn't get a state police job. This was later proven in a class action lawsuit when it was too late to do anything. Due to affirmative action, there were outright quotas. This was in the 1980s. That's how long it's been going on. So, and it, I know people, Gen X, in sort of very august institutions who didn't get, or were told, you can't get that because you're a white man, who are slightly older than me. So yes, it ramped up with our generation, but it was already there. And it's been going on for a long time in some form or another. Arguably since what, the 60s? I don't know.
Even though
it certainly got way worse.
Almost all inventions of any significance since about 2000 BC, more. Look at Human Accomplishment by Charles Murray. He bends over backwards to be inclusive of women. And it's, what could he come up with across that whole period? For British women, what we get: Charlotte Bronte, Emily Bronte, Jane Austen.
That's the thing. Publishing now completely taken over by women. This is one of those many areas men don't even bother with. There was actually Jacob Savage, I think, did a piece about that specifically before this piece. Men don't even bother with literature. I mean, I got my MA in literature. It was a massive interest for me. But who would even bother trying to write as a white man now? Women own so many industries. They own entertainment. Women and a few gay blokes own most of things like comedy. And then they dictate all of publishing. And it's like, all right, if you want to just do that, we'll go and do our podcast and just be racist over here.
Yeah, yeah. Even in publishing, I have a literary agent. If you have one, you probably have the same one. And he, you know, that's the agent for based people. and it's very, very difficult to get past almost all big publishers, small publishers, niche publishers. You might be all right, but with anything that is. With anything that you'll see on the shelves in a shop, basically, it's just all woke dominated.
Oh, yeah, you walk into Waterstones, it's the anarchist, the Antifa handbook. It's like DEI, this critical race, basically the endless just female trash. And even this had already started when I went to university. I've probably said this to you before, Ed, but it was already post-colonial, this and that, post-structures. Roland Barthes. It was always a KB complaining about Joseph Conrad more than we were encouraged to read actually Conrad. So we never got to read the canon. We were deconstructing the canon before we constructed it. So it goes all the way back. But yeah, this exclusion from the job market, just unforgivable and catastrophic. Shall I read a few of the chats, Ed?
These are the paid ones. You should read them, I think.
Ad horny 333 says straight white male tax. That's because I said you need to pay for this because we haven't got money from normal jobs. Someone's put in Stefan V. Mark has put in a South African rand, I think, so I can't tell how much it is, and said beer is too expensive. And the same guy again from the first comment: great discussion, chaps. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you. And again, he says forcing based people to organize is insane. Nick should be presenting on Channel 4 an Ed top uni PhD lecturer. Instead, they're dissidents inspiring the Zoomers. Yeah, imagine what we could have had, Ed, what we should have been. But hey, it's all right. Andrew O'Neill 144 says, would Herbert Austin or George Stevenson whine about this situation or just gone and set up another factory? Well, that's what we have done. I don't think it's whining. You have to address it. No, it's not. I don't know if it means us or.
It's like I'm just stating the empirical facts, and I've been up against them. So has Nick, and we've gone and done stuff. Saying is whining is just playing the left's
there's
game.
There's no whining. There's a deep anger, you know. There's a deep and just almost just like just so much. I don't want to say there's so much anger. I can't. I'm not going to say the words, but
there's so much anger. I can barely find the words to express it.
And then if I do, I go straight to jail in Starmer's Britain. But I think the amount of anger I've seen from people on Twitter sharing these posts has been massive. I've been like, oh, I'm relatively moderate compared to some of these. Let's say Justinian TX says, have you commented on the Sam Hyde MDE case? He seems a good example of the constraints yielding a superior battle-hardened comic who's done more than he might have had it been smooth sailing. I don't know much about that, but I do know Sam Hyde is pretty edgy and funny. And yeah, he he certainly have not made it in anything like the comedy industry. Although in America, it's slightly more permissive and sort of edgy than it is. You know, got the Joe Rogan Club and stuff. Whereas in England, the comedy has just been so pathetic for so many years. Craig Prescott says, why don't men create new institutions in which to flourish once again? That's what we're trying to do. And Dan's comment I've already read out. And Over Vivid says, simply thanks. Well, that's a good comment. I just wanted to get those in case you wanted to go, Ed, because you said we could do about an hour. But is there anything else we've missed about this?
We also got Andrew Wone Ill 144, and he says, okay, thanks for your answers. Cheers, mate.
It's O'Neill, I think. I can read, Ed can't. That's why I didn't get the top jobs.
Muslim girl that got that job lecturing theology. She could read.
She was in her reading. Only read the Quran out loud, but by golly.
Someone said to me the other day on Twitter that he used to work at a famous English public school, and they had this job. The organist or something like that. And someone insisted that it was all men that applied, but except one woman. And someone insisted that that woman be shortlisted, even though she couldn't play the organ. I think she could play the piano. Maybe she could play the keyboard. She could play the keyboard, right? Which is not the same as playing an organ. It's like the difference between an automatic and a manual car. And I get the impression that her attitude was, well, I'll learn it. And just because she was a woman, she was shortlisted. I don't know if she got the job, but she was shortlisted, even though she couldn't play the instrument that the job was desiring you to be able to play.
As we've said in comedy, there are people now who can't speak getting the top comedy gigs. So yeah, this is what happens. But everyone knows it's in comedy. And there was ongoing jokes because people have done like a handful of gigs and they just would get everything straight away. And every white man who'd been, you know, chipping away on the circuit for ages would be like so bitter. So they were aware of it in the comedy world in a different way, but they don't go political about it. They sort of stay within the system and just moan and grumble about it. So they're the people who are whining, really. We've actually gone and torched our careers. Because it took me 11, I was in comedy about 11 years. It's given me some other transferable skills, I guess, but you do, it's like, this was a whole generation. And there was that guy before who did the brilliant video on it. He was talking about hitting a wall in his career, and then he applied for 300 jobs and got like two interviews, and even though he aced them, didn't get it. And there's so many stories like this. I read one about a guy who wanted to be a pilot who was by far the best, but there's a Filipino woman in the room and all the rest are non-white, and he doesn't get it. I mean, all the wasted talent and wasted ability and wasted years. This is over a decade of my life. You've probably wasted time in academia, although at least you've got the sort of, you can use that to write your other books now and things, but I don't know. Do you feel like you've wasted time?
I think I wasted. Yeah, there were definite wasted years when I came to maybe 6 years before I got involved with Richard Lynn and the Alston Institute for Social Research and just thought screw it and started doing based academic research and being paid to do it. But there was a period of about 6 years between when I moved to Finland in 2005 and when I got to know Richard in 2012. Late 2005. Let's say 6 years. Where I was working as a journalist, basically for this sort of English language newspaper aimed at expats. That was part time, and writing articles for things like Times Higher Education, things like that, Times Educational Supplement, various places, and not going there, not daring, playing the game, like not looking at the based research, not looking at science, not looking at logic, but actually playing the game and trying to build up enough publications and in good journals and stuff like this and applying for these jobs in British academia. And I only ever got two interviews. And I don't know how many jobs I applied for. And looking back on it, obviously it was a complete waste of my effort. The only good thing that came out of it was then I got this docentship at Ole University, who've now cancelled me, but they can't get rid of the docentship. And if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been able to get this honorary professorship in various places. So there's some good that came out of it. But in general, it was just a waste of time and I should have done something else. And
It was already in academia. I was considering it. I was doing my master's and considering it. And I realized that they're all Marxists anyway. And then the topics are so niche and specialized and absurd. So I already thought it was kind of dead, especially in the humanities. It was already kind of dead anyway. Just even if it wasn't DEI, it was Marxism and sort of irrelevant nonsense, which is sort of part of the beginning of the same same thing.
Oh, yeah, so much of what is published is absolute bollocks. So here we go. This is the journal Suomen Antropologi from 2011, the Journal of the Finnish Anthropological Association. Let's have a look at some of these articles. Eva Berglund, Tangled and Tangible, Straight and Abstract, Anthropology and Helsinki Architecture. Mudjzim Udin and Leila Ashafrun, Daughters of the Dark, a qualitative study of street-based sex workers in Bangladesh. So what she's doing is basically journalism. She's going up to sex workers in Bangladesh and talking to them and then writing it down. And I mean, so much of it. What's this one? Mariana Kelly Salo Galvan, Lectio Precursorio, Cosmic Clowns, Convention, Invention and Inversion in the Yakui Easter Ritual. But what's the point?
We're so over-specialized. I miss the days when you could be like, what's your topic? Plato. What's yours? The Bible. Like, you go back in time, that's what it was. It was, you know, you could be that. You could be a sort of generalist. You could be a Da Vinci type person. C.S. Lewis realized, he had a debate. I can't remember who it was with now. It was a woman whose name escapes me. There was a couple of things that sort of points she sort of kneeled him on in his argument, which ended up in the book Miracles. Or it was in the book Miracles, and he rewrote it. And she got him on a few points. He was like, oh, I'm going to have to be so specialized if I'm going to carry on with philosophy in the analytical era, where it became more analytical and about analysis of language. He's like, I'm just going to stop bothering with these kind of books. I'm going to go just write fiction, because he realized it'd have to be so specialized. But before that, you could be a sort of general philosopher, which C.S. Lewis kind of was. You could just be like, here's what I think. I'm a really clever guy who's thought it through. But now it's like, you've got, it's the head of a pin. It's just like so specialized in all of the arts. I don't even know what your speciality actually is anymore, because you do so many things.
It keeps changing. Yeah, well, at the moment, I'm I've got a book that will come out, actually, no, it's the year after next, it'll come out, on advanced ancient civilizations that have vanished. So I've been doing that for a while. But in general, I still, in terms of research articles, it's still kind of evolutionary psychology and things like that. For example, I've got a paper coming out quite soon on race differences in oral sex preference and extent.
Look forward to that one.
Yeah. So that's the sort of fundamental thing. But yeah, originally it was just my PhD thesis was on fundamentalist evangelical Christian students at universities. That's what it was on. And now, by the way, a lot of those groups that I studied have been banned from their student unions and are not allowed to meet on student union property. So that's another change that's happened. They already have a kind of persecution complex because they're in the world and not of the world. And then they have a very good reason to have it, because they're literally being banned because they espouse, as far as they are concerned, biblical Christianity. And that's offensive. That's offensive and unacceptable.
Right.
And so, you know, they're being banned as well, and this of course creates more of a sort of an echo chamber and a kind of polarization effect. But yeah, it's the thing that's more interesting that I don't know that needs to be looked at more. Like there needs to be almost like a truth and reconciliation commission, but with teeth. That looks at what are the, as you said, the second order, third order. What are the effects of this? What has this done? How has this impacted people's lives? And then there needs to be reparations.
Yeah, I'm up for reparations. And by the way, someone's saying it was Hume's. No, I was talking about G.E.M. Anscombe, who Lewis debated, 1948 Oxford Socratic Club debate. So there you go. So you're right, actually, Ed. We need reparations. What form should... thank you to Tuxedo MA5K, who says society could not survive 100 years of suffrage. Interesting point. Probably right. Obviously, women shouldn't vote. That's a given on this stream. What should the reparations look like, Ed?
They should be forced to build a time machine and go back in time to the early 2000s and then and ensure that my academic career and your comedy career and those of related people, you know, go as planned. And if they can't afford to build a time machine or don't have the ability to do so because of DEI,
well, that's what I was going to say. Of course they can't.
Only
white. The irony is, only white men could do it.
That's the irony. We would have that time machine had they not done that, had they not followed these policies. But we don't. We would be living in space by now. We would have conquered Mars, obviously. That goes without saying. But we haven't.
Is that why Musk is so against this stuff? Because he knows he can't get to Mars with a bunch of DEI hires.
Of course he can't go to bar. He knows perfectly well he can't go. He can't. What if they were to menstruate over important aeronautical instruments?
Yeah. So was astronauts. What if
we lived in a different part of the multiverse. I mean, no, you didn't. Okay, didn't.
The astronaut test is biased towards white men, Caucasians.
It is. The astronaut test needs to be rewritten. All of the hard astronaut questions need to be taken off because certain people don't do well in them. No. So I think it should. I don't know. I mean, there won't be compensation, obviously, because it will bankrupt. It will just bankrupt society. But what we need is something more like in America. Amendments and whatever, such these things can never, ever, ever happen again. We need to have law. It is a crime to discriminate against somebody on the basis that they are male or that they are, and it's very, very specific. You cannot be in any industry at all, ever, for any reason. And also, there needs to be law, I think, stating that there is absolute freedom of speech, except that it is a criminal offence to suggest there should be restrictions on freedom of speech.
And I've heard a few people say this is a political problem that needs a political solution. It's all right saying to the individual, oh, just buck up and work harder and all that, which we've had all that. We've heard all that. But this was a generational thing and it was a political thing. And I remember hearing in comedy from inevitably white folks, one even said to me, and he sort of accepted it. He just goes, well, you know, white men were doing well for a bit, whatever. Now it's just our time to sit it out. And I was thinking, really? Is that how life works? Like, we may come back as other people, Ed, or we may have eternal life in heaven. But really, you come down as this particular individual wants. You know, you don't really tend to come back as the same bloke. You have that one chance. Oh, I'm just going to sit it out now because of what, colonialism or something?
And now not even my ancestors did. Things that the elite that were there when my ancestors were knocking about did.
What that does to you as an individual, and we're seeing it now with all the anger, all these white men coming out. It's like, oh, I just can't have a life. I'm what? Because you're racist. Oh, I see. Like, it's never okay. It's not going to be okay. It can't be. There's no one that happens to you just goes, yeah, fair enough. The wokest person resents that in their heart. No one accepts that. No one goes, you know what? I shouldn't have anything. You're absolutely right. Even if I'm really good or try really hard, I should have nothing because of my mutable characteristics. What a great point. No one thinks that, even if they say it. And you
not even the lowest of the lowest Dalit. Thinks that they compete against, they are discriminated against, and it's awful because of the caste in which they are born, but they still compete and they still come up with they still try. No one's, oh yeah, I'm a Dalit, yeah, I deserve not to be able to get tea from that shop because I'm a Dalit. I deserve that, yeah, because I was bad in the past life, yeah, I deserve it. They fight against it and they try and gain something back, and we have been encouraged to be weak for so long, and as you say, there's this I hate that word, concatenation, whatever it is, of factors that have come together. I think also relevant is the fact that woke people don't breed. So part of what's going on among white people.
And you
people,
get back to your book.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, if you're watching on Nick's channel, that's Woke Eugenics, How Social Justice Masks Social Darwin.
The least controversial title for a book.
This
is what happened. You stop people having a career. They go, right, fine, I'm writing a book called Woke Eugenics. I think of the most controversial two words. I've just brought them together, haven't I?
That's the brilliance of it. They are that you wouldn't expect them to be together. So it's a juxtaposition, which is the kind of words that kids aren't being taught these days. And so I love the way that Piers Morgan on the interview with Nick Fuentes didn't know the difference between infer and imply.
Well, he also didn't know what per capita was, and that was the most embarrassing. We don't know if he was pretending or not, but he couldn't grasp the concept of per capita. And he's like, well, how many white people do school shootings? Well, how many black people commit crimes? Like, no, Piers, it's the relative number in each category. There's hardly any white people doing school shootings. There's a lot of black people proportionately committing these type of violent crimes. But he couldn't or wouldn't grasp that, nor could his whole team, because you could hear that. You could tell he kept reading out things. How about this stat? And then you could tell they were reading him in his ear, and they were kept trying to address Nick's point, but they were all dumb, so none of them could address it, or they were all disingenuous. So every time he kept reading out something else, it was also irrelevant. And that's when Fuentes said, are you playing dumb, or you're actually dumb?
That strikes me as rather unfair. That strikes me, you know how I never understood about blockbusters, was you'd have this system where there'd be one team with one person on it, and one team with two people on it. And that always struck me as rather unfair.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought I'd hate to be on Blockbusters and be the person on the singleton team rather than the person who has two.
It was probably one white man, though. It was one white man against two DEI guys.
Probably. I don't know. But anyway, the point is that that's what Piers was going on with. I didn't know this. That was what was happening with Piers and Nick, that Piers has Piers has all his mates. So as you know, if you've read the Piers Dorgan comic strip in Viz, are innumerable.
He posted on TV, you see, Ed, so I could just tell when he suddenly came out with something, I could tell that's been fed into him using my insider knowledge of the time.
Oh, I see. Yes. I knew the same thing with friends of mine that are actors. And we watch something on telly and they'll go, he's fluffed that line, they've had to redo that. And they just know. Like, I know when I'm reading an academic article, I'm like, he's only written that bit in there because the reviewers have told him to.
Right.
And I just instinctively know he doesn't mean that. He doesn't want to write that because it's completely incongruous with everything else he's saying. A peer reviewer, a left-wing peer reviewer, has made him write that, and he has to write it or he can't get the paper published.
Do you know what? It reminds me of it. I can probably say this because my GB News contract ended like last week. They said I was on GB and I was hosting, and they wanted me to say that the Southport rioters were far right, and I wouldn't say it, and I kept getting it in my ear. And because there's always that one guy out with the tattoos of swastikas and stuff, I said, okay, well, and some of them may have been far right. I said it kind of once unenthusiastically. This wasn't deemed enough, and I never hosted again. So I wouldn't throw the people under the bus on the People's Channel. But that made me think as well, one thing we didn't quite cover is you've got things like GB came up, which gave me a lifeline for a few years, an actual contract and some money. That's now gone. So I'm back in the wilderness again. And I could still probably go on if they don't watch this stream. I've been offered. I just haven't really done it because it wouldn't be the same as being on contract. My point here, though, Ed, is that these things emerge. Then they're sort of a lifeline, but then they have their own limitations, don't they? And they kind of become, and they also play the game as well, a little bit of diverse. They don't play it to the same degree, but they do still, the amount of gay presenters on GB News is like, there can't be that many gay people in the country. Talk about per capita. They're like massively overrepresented. And also the kind of views you can have are quite limited and certain things you're not supposed to say. I just gave an example there. So there's also these things that are sort of a slight reaction to this. GB is definitely a reaction to all this, but they're limited.
Yeah, I mean, I can think also, but they're also subject to change. So I'd like to say I'm sympathetic to them, but I'm a very unsympathetic person. I'm very low in empathy, so that would be a lie. But I would say that there are podcasts that have had me on more recently that have said to me, "We couldn't have done this in the past. You were too controversial, but you're not anymore." So
because of people me have laundered you,
right? Well, perhaps so. Yeah. people like Lyle Shriver, and Graham Linehan, and
Dr. David Starkey,
Stevie. And Simon Baron Cohen, and whatever, launched me. Perhaps that's the case, but I don't know if that's the case. But I think what's more the case is that I haven't changed my views, but the acceptability of what I've been saying has changed because you've had this baseness signalling in the right, as it were, such that the risk of having someone like Nick Fuentes, clearly. Is less than used to be the case, and someone like Tucker Carlson is therefore prepared to work. What's the risk reward ratio here? There's a serious risk. If it goes well, yeah. And so you go for it. Now with GB News, they haven't got, and whatever that thing is, the new culture for that's another one. They haven't quite got there yet, at least in relation to me. I've had things like they've asked me to come on and then cancelled it because someone from high up has said. I've had things like that. But it's moving in that direction now. Do I understand that? Yeah, you know, they've got to get the balance right between being edgy but not getting themselves in serious trouble. I kind of do. Do I do that myself? Yes, I probably do, but it's got to be very edgy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be really, really out there for me to say, well, hang on a minute, I think you might have a point, but steady on, and I can't. This is not.
Yeah, we don't want to see the person that Ed thinks is too out there. I mean, yeah, look, I do wonder about all the. I was foolishly as well on Love Seekers the other day, critiqued Unheard and Spectator because they're both backed by Sir Paul Marshall, who backs GB, but they're also both run by Freddie Sayers, who's in overall control, even though Gove is the editor. And they're publishing these very strange things, like Unheard published Is Reform Too Christian? And they also published Muslims are the future. Islam's the future of Britain, and Unheard. And then Spectator had Bonnie Blue in there, and you sort of go, "What is this that's being pushed exactly?" And then Renaud Camus was on Unheard, but they gave him like a sort of Piers Morgan gotcha interview, and you go, "Like, what is being pushed to me here?" So I do wonder if that's going to be any better long term. But hey, it's a sort of it became a haven for people. Anyway, we know all about this. There's different levels of baseness. But this DEI thing created that whole world, I suppose. It created all those spheres. And then within those worlds, you can decide how base you are and how how propelled by anger you are about everything that's happened. To me, it's no good just to, all this has happened, but now I'm going to settle in this new place and just play the game there. It's not really, I'm not apparently capable of that. Apparently,
no, that's why I agree with, that's why I have some sympathy for that point, is reform to Christian. I have some, if something is pushed down my throat and I'm told I have to accept this, then that wrangles with me. And I will, yeah. If you tell me I can't say certain things or think certain things, even if you're saying that from the right, then I'm not having that. And that's my genuine concern about the direction that things are going, that it will be like that poem High Windows by Larkin, where he says, oh, I see a young couple and she's on the pill. She's taking pills and wearing a diaphragm. And I know that he's fucking her. And I know this is paradise. All their lot have gone down the long slide like three bloody birds. That famous poem. But I don't want that. That was written probably in the mid 60s or something. I don't want that in reverse. I don't want a nostalgic future poet living in a kind of American evangelical Christian England, which is what that reform, I don't know if you saw it, that reform
I think I do
video of them all being all churchy.
Mm-hmm. I watched that.
Right, had. That's what it was like. That's what it reminded me of, the sort of sleek, 1980s evangelical Christian American sort of videos. That's what it reminded me of. It's very un-English.
I thought it was quite English. I think I want to go back to that. I think that's where we differ, but that might be because you're not as Christian as me. But someone did stop me in the street the other day and say, go easy on the brothers. And I tried to ask what he meant. It turned out he felt that GB News was too harsh to Afro-Caribbeans. I was like, really? I don't think that's true. But he said, you want to go back to the 50s. That's the reason that popped into my head. I think I do want to go back, but you don't want to go back.
I think I'd like to go back to, let's say, maybe about 1970.
Okay.
And then just sort of stay there. Because one of the things actually that you note is that the level of, I'd love someone to do a paper on this. I could do it myself, but it's just so much work. It's the kind of thing that Charles Murray would be good at doing. It's to quantify the degree to which that period, post 50s, right, where the ideology shifts from basically being conservative and group oriented to being individually oriented and left wing. And there's going to be this period between where the conservative ideology has collapsed and the left-wing replacement ideology hasn't risen up yet. And it strikes me that that's probably about 1965 to about the year 2000 or something like that. And I wouldn't mind betting that that's the most creative period in terms of original music and like highly original music and all kinds of stuff like this and all kinds of original. I bet that is. I bet that is. But that's my hypothesis anyway. But that would have to be quantitatively demonstrated. And it would be extremely complicated to do, and it would involve a huge amount of work. Because then after that you get new restrictions, you get new taboos, you get new pressures, you get new things you can't say. And I certainly don't think there's been any funny sitcom since the IT Crowd. And that's almost 20 years. That's like, what, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, yeah, there can't be. And that's probably one thing we should have just talked about more. But I'll just briefly say everything. There can't be good movies now. Very, very. You watch them, they're nearly all awful if you try and watch them. People argue where the cutoff is. I said at one point 2011 because you had Margin Call, Warrior, and something else good that I can't remember. Then I think 2014, some people say, because I think it had The Big Short and it had The Drop. But you can argue around that time. It kind of ends after that. It's very hard to get a good film. It's a real outlier if you do. And there are reasons for this, and it's all the reasons we've discussed. I mean, one thing is you just can't have the explicit ideology of wokeness. Any explicit ideology just shoehorned into a film would be probably quite bad, but especially wokeness, which is an inherently rubbish ideology. If every film just about espousing that rather than about the story, of course it's going to be rubbish. And if no white men have written it, it's going to be even worse. So we've just had the death of films, probably music, certainly comedy, and virtually everything else, TV.
Yeah, and you can't if you shoehorn an ideology into it, it's much harder to suspend disbelief. So I've got to sort of enter into this fantasy world where I'm in Elizabethan England. Oh look, there's a black man that's the Lord Chancellor. Right, that makes it more difficult for me to suspend disbelief. That ruins the
disbelief. I will turn it off. I turned off a film 5 minutes from the end because of a bit of woke casting. I was like, no. Even though the ending was like, I still don't want to watch the ending and find out what happens, because I'm that hardcore. My Hardy Ha says, super chat, good conversation. Thank you very much. I think it was great. We went on a little bit, maybe. I think it was the first hour was very energetic. Now I thought people have got to get their money's worth. So I've done an hour and a half. That's a decent chunk. Is there anything else you want to add, Ed?
No, no. We should, like the original British Office, we should end it off in the second series and not go on and thus leave the viewer wanting more.
Yeah, lots of people have loved it. I mean, there are loads of people watching, which I think are mainly from your channel, to be fair, which is a lot bigger than
watching.
Mine.
How many are watching?
Well, by my standards, quite a lot, but I don't name the number in case it's actually low. But it's like a decent amount. If I say the number, then you're like, that's not high. But it's more than I normally get on a live stream. I don't know what to do. I haven't decided what to do here because guests are so annoying. I guess you kind of count as a guest, but I wasn't counting this as a guest. They're so annoying. They don't show up or they cancel. It's a nightmare. I've decided to not really do guests, maybe just do solo videos, maybe occasionally do a guest and do my thing with Paul Cox and stuff. But I don't know what I'm going to do because my contacts ended. It's a new world. Any tips are welcome, by the way. Don't know why I'm asking you in public, but
I don't know.
But just, this is a one-off. We can do more of these kind of thing, maybe, because people seem to like it.
As they do, well, as and when they come up. Yeah, I'm thinking at the moment, you know, who should I get on? Maybe like Limpet Opic or something. And there's some like people from the past. I recently had Nick Griffin on, and people seem to like that. So they people from the past, like Timmy Mallett. Get Timmy Mallett on. Yeah, that's not what I'll write that down.
Mallett would be good. He's from the peak era of Britain.
I bet he's based because that woman, Liz Kershaw, she's based. And I remember as a kid in the late 80s listening on the radio to Bruno Brooks and Liz Kershaw. So a lot of people that have sort of been away for a bit from fame have come back and suddenly they're all sort of based. It's quite interesting. Bruno Brooks.
Someone says, is Nick the best presenter on Lotus Eaters apart from Carl, of course? Well, no, it's actually including Carl. But thank you for that comment. That was Alec Karras 90, but we can't really read it because it's not paid. But thank you so much. I gave you an extra bonus there. Thanks for coming to this then. Thanks for doing it, Ed. I'm on nickdixon.net if you want to get my extra stuff, including my many interviews with Ed. That's where all my paywalled stuff is, nickdixon.net. It's only £5, or it's £4.17, I think, for the whole year. It averages out. I think Ed's raised his prices, so his is a lot more expensive.
Yeah, but it's better. So please, if you're on Nick's channel, you get what you pay for. It's like Stubbs versus O'Reilly. Back when comedy was good. If you subscribe, so please subscribe on YouTube to Jolly Heretic and on Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most base stuff I can't put on YouTube in person, YouTube vlogs, films I make, that kind of thing, and where you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month, or well, not a pint of beer in London, though, a pint of beer somewhere sensible. Thanks for having me on. It's jolly interesting chat.
Thanks for doing it. Thanks for everyone for watching. We'll see you very soon. See you on the flip side, as they say. No one says that anymore. And goodbye.
Bye-bye.